I'd like to go to Lao Tzu, and this is in the Tao Te Ching. This is the 42nd chapter. And the translation that I'm using is the one that D.T. Suzuki made in Chicago in 1898. I like it because Suzuki, who was only 21 at the time, and fresh from a very strong master, Soyin Shaku, understood that in order to teach, you have to show, you have to display structure, that the student will never have insight unless you can display structure accurately. It's the accurate display of structure that evokes from the student, even subconsciously, the intuitive insight, so that what is understood is the pattern, the shape, the gestalt, which holds the information in its unity. And that is essential. And it's essential in consciousness. It's essential in thought consciousness to be able to see the shape of learning, to be able to see the structure of both the setting of the material and the material itself and the process of how the material works. So by structure we don't mean just a static girder, steel girder aspect, but the flow process is a structure also. And it's to that point that the 42nd chapter of the Lao Tzu is devoted. In Asia, in both India and China, and consequently in Japan and Korea, everywhere else, in Asia, the cultural norm has preserved the five-part structure of the flow of reality as seen by thought consciousness. In the West, we have devolved to the extent that we understand it as a four-part static snapshot kind of a structure, and have lost the cultural facility, the personal recountability of the fifth part, the quintessence, as it were. Now, in the Hermetic tradition, it's never been lost. And in the Hermetic tradition, for instance, recognized by Jung in his alchemical studies, the fifth element is always the aspect which lifts the quaternary out of its stasis into its dynamis, into its power, out of its appearance. A static stasis is always an appearance, but when it's put in motion, then it's dynamic, from its stasis to its dynamis. The dynamis is real in regard to the mere appearance of the stasis. So that in the Western wisdom tradition, you have a conscious differentiation which is not very easily understood by Asians at all. And it accounts for the tremendous ascendancy of the Western psyche in terms of science in the last 500 years. I don't think it's so much a historical miraculous flaw as something which was designed. I really, the more I see it and the older I get, the more I think it was built in, that this particular failure on the part of the colloquial Western mind and the subsequent emphasis on the esoteric aspect as a missing element that must be found. I think all of that was designed a long time ago. But be that as it may, in the Western tradition, the structure is that appearance is static while the real is dynamic. Probably the most conspicuous 20th century example of this comparison is in the phenomenological philosopher Martin Heidegger, who attempted to write an extremely complicated, massive, objective, descriptive work about human beingness. The German word that Heidegger used was Dasein, being there. He tried to abstract what it is that a human being is and to write a book on this, describing this. It was like an anatomy of the phenomenological abstract structure of a human being. The book is called Sein und Zeit, or Being and Time. And the first part was to be a overall picture of this, and then the subsequent parts to bring in the aspect of time, to bring in the aspect of movement. Well, he did the first part very, very adequately. By 1926 or 27, he had written it. But when it came to introducing time, to putting the structure into motion, the entire philosophy fell apart. He never finished it. He died in 1976, and even 50 years later, he never finished it. In fact, towards the end of his life, he became more and more preoccupied with the fact that early Greek thought, pre-Socratic, pre-Socrates thought, had put their finger on the very issue which he had failed to come to terms with. And all of his later books are about what is thought, what is thinking, what is a work of literature, and books of that nature. What is the nature of language? All of his later works. And so he's become influential as a philosopher of interpretation, interpreting hermeneutics. This is the dragon. We must learn to tame and not slay. The classic Western wisdom tradition is that in an appearance mode, in an image mode which represents nature, the realm of appearances is understandable to man, as long as the correspondence between the appearance in its image fits accurately to its referent in nature, so that you can trust the images that you're working with if they correspond accurately to the things in nature. Now the bugbear in this is to realize that nature is not static at all, but is changing, is moving. So that you have to find some kind of a correspondence of change and movement to put into your image base. And generally,
Those are the relations between the images, how they're arranged, in what proportions, and so forth. The classic statement of those arrangements of things and their movements in an image base is in Aristotle's book on rhetoric. And I brought out, we have six or seven translations of the rhetoric. The one that I have used for a long time and the one that is really recognized, I think, as the best is in the Oxford Collected Works of Aristotle, about 12 volumes. The general editor was W.D. Ross, but the translator of the Rhetorica is W. Rise Roberts. And this is an extremely powerful little book. Aristotle's Rhetoric, which has been ignored for the last, I think the last 200 years. But Aristotle's Rhetoric in antiquity and in the Renaissance was one of the most important of all of his books. Now let's recap and see where we've gotten to. We're trying to negotiate intelligently in this world. We believe, after long trial and error and collecting of experience and comparing of experience, that nature is trustworthy. It's a trustworthy basis. And if the images which we are working with are related closely to nature, and the closest relationship would be one-to-one. This image stands for that thing. That whatever manipulations of the images that we are able to do, we are then able to turn around and manipulate nature in exactly the same way. So that the images become a model, and the word is model, of nature. But the Western wisdom tradition says that this model is only an appearance and does not have the properties of nature in actuality. That the properties of the model are projected upon nature so that it seems like nature has those properties. But they are not properties of nature, but properties of a model. So the Western wisdom tradition has always and ever always will be critical of this standpoint. Not that it's not so, but that it is only a preliminary stage and is not a finished stage, and you can only trust it if you're in the first grade. That the clue is that one is taking the structure of an image base and able to project upon nature and then find in nature the structure of the image base. That realization on that basic level is the beginnings of magic. It's the beginning of magical power. It's the beginning of the sense that what I do with these images, whatever shape I put them in, I can project that shape on nature and nature will follow. And thus there's an inversion. Our images are not an imitation of nature, but nature becomes an imitation of our images. Now the Western wisdom tradition is always careful to point out that this exactly is the nature of evil. That is the root, core, gut of the nature of evil. Once one has fallen into that, projective trap, as it were. In terms of that trap, there is no way that you could rectify that error. Nature has the properties which we have given it in our arrangement of it, because we have arranged our images that way, and our images are direct correspondence to things in nature. And everything checks out. All the ledgers are balanced. And as long as you leave it on that horizon, on that level, all the ledgers are balanced. And there is no way to detect the error, because the error is not in any workings of that whole ecology, but in the fact that that whole ecology is erroneous as a whole. There's no way to go within terms of that parenthetical limitation and discover that one is in a limited mode. It cannot be done. So that the Western wisdom tradition says that one has to, first of all, get out of the world of habit that you find yourself in. You have to wake up in the sense that you have to let go of the certainty that you have that the way that you are operating in this world is correct. It may seem correct to you, and it may be for all intents and purposes that what you do, that it is correct, but in fact, the entire ensemble of you and what you do and the way you understand nature and the way you deal with nature, that entire ensemble is, let's be generous, let's use the term crippled. Let's not use the term evil. Although the wisdom tradition has always been careful to point out that this is hell. Man forcing nature to take the shapes of his imagined structures on the basis that, well, since they're directly correspondent to nature anyway, I have the right to do this. Late Renaissance characterizations of this was the French philosopher Descartes, who was convinced that when animals squeal with pain, that it's just a mechanical reaction. They don't have any feeling. It's a misunderstanding on a very gross level. And it cannot be corrected as long as one remains in that horizon, that level. So that in the Western tradition, the emphasis is always that the way out, the way to wake up from that, is to realize that that static structure has a dimensional change when you put it into movement. That when you add the dynamis to it, and the word which is circulating in our generation, empowerment, is just a simple statement of this, that when you add that dynamis to that structure, not only will that structure fall apart, it will misshape itself the more you move it. It's just like an Einsteinian view of the world, that the faster you move an object, the more it occupies a mass in this universe. That correspondent distortionality is not descriptive of nature so much, but descriptive of the way in which the mind understands nature. That as one moves with more and more dynamis, the static structure more and more loses its appearance integrity and attains to its real integrity. Now this is a very, very, very difficult. If one doesn't know this already, it's difficult to know what anyone is talking about. So let's move to Lao Tzu. Let's move to China for a moment, and then I'll bring in India for a second, and then we'll go on to Shakespeare, and we'll see. There, the world of appearance was never mistaken for the real. This fundamental flaw, this fundamental error, was never made. But consequently, the development of science was always subsumed under a kind of a peculiar naivete and was never seen in its objective usefulness in terms of technology. Occasionally there was some, but very rarely. And so much so that Chinese civilization, we'll use China for a minute, Chinese civilization, when it developed to the point to where there would have been a technological capacity, the Chinese social mind stopped it dead in its tracks. Chinese science was completely stopped in its development in the probably towards the end of the Sung, the beginning of the Yuan dynasty. So that China never developed the kind of technology which the West developed, even though they had a very strong base for it. It did not seem important to them. Whereas in the West, exactly at that same time, in the 13th century, it became apparent to a few individuals in the West, the greatest of them was Roger Bacon, that this whole emphasis on the difference between the real and the appearance was exactly the function of science to disclose. That science was the culmination of the wisdom tradition, and the development of a technology was the tool by which to show man that his narrow view of the world was inadequate to the wholeness of the natural universe. That science was the key to the cosmos, and it's of the devil's own that in the 20th century that should be completely inverted, that science is somehow the enemy of religion. In the 13th century, when it was first realized, it was understood that science is actually the whole basis by which religion becomes real. So we live in a very odd century and time. Fortunately, there are enough mature human beings in the realm of science and religion. There have always just been enough to make sure that this great lie is not told conclusively. And in our time, fortunately in our generation, books like the Tao of Physics that have come out have just blatantly made the point that there is no way that one can confuse science with a kind of a demonic misperception of spiritual reality. They in fact go together. They always have gone together. In traditional Chinese thought and society, the five-part movement of the real, is first expressed in the 42nd chapter of the Tao Te Ching, written 500 BC, somewhere around there. It reads like this, and this is not a literate translation, but it's a word for character translation. So you can see you have to intuit the movement of sense between the words, which is just how it should be. The title of this section, it isn't numbered. None of the Tao Te Ching was numbered. The numbering came later on in the Han Dynasty, towards the end of the Han Dynasty, 200 AD in our. In Lao Tzu, there were no numbers at all. But there was a double character, two characters, that gave an indication that here comes an expression which is of a whole, that all the terms in the following expressions, like a colon. And the two Chinese characters, the first one is Dao, and the second one is Hua, and Hua is like transformation. It comes from the I Ching, Hua. I guess in a clumsy, basic way, we would say the permutations. But that all the permutations together are an ecology of transformation. And that transformation then is the shape of all of the possible permutations understood as an idea. So Hua in English well means transformation. So Dao's transformation, and then the whole sequence that follows is Dao's transformation. And it's like a ribbon. It has to be seen as one. I hate to use the word thing here. It isn't one thing. It's one configuration. That's the better term. One configuration. It begins with the character again for Dao. So you have Dao's transformations. Dao, the next word, the next character is sometimes pronounced Shang, but I think my teacher told me that the ancient translation in terms of sound made it rhyme with the word for phoenix, and the ancient Chinese word for phoenix, feng, feng. It's an odd kind of a sound. It's like an F sharp string on an instrument. Feng. It rhymes with that, and it's sheng, sheng. And sheng means produces. It's almost like the sound of the word itself. Sheng is like it makes, it produces. How does it produce? It produces by the resonance of what this is. Or as Plotinus would say, by emanations of what this is. The difference between resonances and emanations. We are accurate in thinking of resonances as like further arcs of part of the shape of what it is. But an emanation in Plotinus' idea, and quite accurate incidentally, is that the whole shape repeats. So that if one could spiritually see accurately, if you struck a bell, the shape of the bell is the shape of which the sound wave goes out. And the human soul is of such a nature that if it hears the sound from any direction, it gets the shape of the bell. In the mind, in the deep mind. It's like one of the conclusive proofs in antiquity that man's soul was a unity, was that from any part he could construct the whole. And in the Pythagorean mode, that if one was able to hear the sound of any celestial body, one could hear the sound of the system as a whole, the music of the spheres as a whole. You would hear with the ear one sound, one planet. But in your soul's hearing, you would hear the music of the spheres. Now, this was thought to be metaphorical in the 18th and 19th century and everything. And we know today, for instance, because of science, that every planet has its own sound. Every planet in our star system, or any planet in any star system, has a bow shock wave as it moves through the energy matrix and produces a sound. I'll try and get some recordings from JPL so you can hear the sounds of the planets. Uranus and Saturn and Jupiter, and they're all different. They actually do sound. There is actually a music of the spheres. The star system as a whole has a harmonia. And if all the notes were played together, one could hear with the physical ear the harmony. Well, one can, in fact, in the deep inner spirit, one can hear the whole of that. So that when the Chinese term Sheng is used here, Lao Tzu means that Tao Sheng unity. The unity is not different from the Tao, but is the Tao now given wholeness? The shape of the wholeness is unity. Tao is the wholeness, the shape of the wholeness is unity. So when Lao Tzu says, Tao Sheng Yi, it's saying a fantastic reality, like the Pythagorean music of the spheres. Now, the unity is not an image of the Tao. It's the shape of the wholeness that is the Tao. So that the unity now is able to do something. What is it able to do? It's able to do in a parallel resonant way Yi Sheng Hui. Unity produces duality. Now it's very important to understand, to not slide in your mind, to not fall back on old habits of hearing. The duality is not different from unity. It is a different shape from unity, but is still the shape of the Tao. It's just a different shape. So that the image of duality, Ri, is the yin-yang. The image of the unity is the Tai Chi. The Tao is what it is. The image of the Tao is not a representation of the Tao, but is a presentation of the Tao in shapedness. That little smoothness saved Chinese civilization from making the kind of erroneous and also the kind of scientific development which the West underwent in the last 500 years. Now, because this Tai Chi as an image presents the Tao, does not represent it. It's not a representation of something else, but it's a presentation of itself. The Tai Chi is a symbol. A real symbol, a true symbol, presents itself. What is itself? Itself is a focus of meaning, which has been brought together in this configuration, this shape. So the way to understand a symbol is to read a symbol in terms of the meaning which it has brought together. So it's like a navel. And one contemplates it just like a yoga of the navel, that this is where all of the meanings are put together in a bow. Or if they're misunderstood, put together into a knot. It's like that. Not only is unity that, but duality in the Chinese mind is that also. The yin-yang together are also that. So that the duality produces Ri, Sheng, San is the Chinese word for three. San. Duality produces a trinity. I think even though D.C. Suzuki uses trinity here to have assonance with duality, maybe for our kinds of English, because of the more sophisticated kind of mind that we have in terms of the English language, I would probably urge you to think of triadness. Or to make it even more strange and weird, triadicness. Because for us, Trinity has a theological connotation, which Lao Tzu does not have at all. And threeness is sophomoric. It's not threeness, it's triadicness. The triadicness is also a legitimate, real shape of the Tao. It's not derivative by any sense. It's not second rate in terms of duality's first rate. Or it's not third rate in terms of duality's second rate and unity's first rate. There's no pecking order at all. There's no hierarchy at all. The traditional Taoist way, the way I was taught about yin and yang, is that this is yin and that is yang. Movement and stillness. Movement is yang, stillness is yin. So that in order to think with this kind of a quality before one has to use your entire being, as it were. Did I threaten that machine? Try to calm down. The machines are having trouble. What I'm trying to deliver to you is a sense that this is a primordial realization. And the primordiality of it is that it is eternal. It is always so. It never is not so. And we have a particular difficulty with it because we try to reduce it right away. We subconsciously try to reduce it so that we have to fight to maintain clarity of mind in terms of accurate process. And it shows up all the time when Westerners try to meditate. When Westerners try to meditate, what they experience is anxiety. And if a Westerner doesn't know, the closer they come to their deep self, the more anxiety they experience. And so they're convinced that this is not the way to go. I can't take it, is usually the colloquial phrase. And they're literally thrown back into the bullshit world. And they're convinced that, well, I'm not going to do that. That's dangerous. That's no good for me. And the kicker in that is just this aspect that we don't let process be. And the way to let process be is to realize that these different shapes are the wholeness. They don't represent the wholeness. They are the wholeness, so that one can trust in that. One doesn't have to feel anxious about that. That is so. It is so. So in Lao Tzu, in the Tao Te Ching, in the 42nd chapter, it's the very core. The core is in the Lao Tzu in China, and in the Indian tradition, it's the Taittiriya Upanishad, which I spoke on Thursday night, and cassettes are available. It also has the five kosas, the five sheaths, which are the five-part process. Whether it's food or vital breath or mind, thought or bliss, it's the five-part structure. It's not just that India and China agree on the fundamental shape of reality, but the Western esoteric tradition also agrees. How can it not agree? It is, in fact, the eternal truth of the matter. In the West, though, if you add the quintessence, the quaternary structure of the static becoming dynamic reveals not a five-part, but reveals a wholeness. When you add the quintessence, when you add the fifth part, in the Western esoteric tradition, you don't get five, but you get the real. But the four-part, egotistical, quaternary sense of self vanishes. Or as Salvador Dali used to say, it goes to its maximum speed, which is instantaneity. The four-part wheel spins so fast that as a wheel, it is no longer there. It is only spin. And if you're counting on looking good in front of the mirror and you don't see anything in the mirror, you can get really worried. And if nobody ever told you, well, the good man has no shape. What's that Wallace Stevens poem about that? And people talk about this all the time. Well, it's like in St. John's rendition, Jesus says, well, do you know where the wind comes from? Do you know where it goes? And then he says, with authority, no one knows. Because that reality doesn't have a shapedness in any kind of an image way. It has to be experienced without an image. See, in Lao Tzu, that term sheng produces shows that the first phase, what we would call the first phase, is before unity. So I've used the designation for a long time that Tao is like zero, in the sense that the transformation sequence is zero-based. Not one-based, but zero-based. For instance, every fraction of zero is zero. So the common denominator of all of the elements is zero. Have you ever seen a fraction written 1/0? So the arithmetical progression of fractions based on unity is an appearance mode which is satisfactory as long as you're dealing with a limited situation. But when you're dealing like with higher mathematics, you have to not deal with a limited appearance, but you have to deal with the real universe the way it really is, and it has to be zero-based. And one of the great leaps with Newton and Leibniz is the realization that when you deal with a mathematical language on that kind of a basis, you can describe movement accurately to any degree of sophistication that's specified. That is a tremendous achievement. That is a spiritual realization. And Newton and Leibniz were anything but anti-religious. Newton devoted the last 30 years of his life to try to decipher the prophecies of Daniel and the Apocalypse, because in his insightful genius, he knew they went together. He didn't know how, because at that time, biblical scholarship just was not sophisticated enough to ever disclose why. But in fact, they go together like yin and yang. But even with his genius, he was just outdistanced by the incapacity of the world of his time to understand. It's like Scott trying to go to the South Pole and get back. He's just outdistanced by the inadequacy of the time. In Lao Tzu, in the 42nd chapter, Tao produces unity. Unity produces duality, or we would say more specifically in our time, complementarity. Complementarity. Niels Bohr's word for this is exceeding